Mel Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm sitting in a nature reserve called, I'm not joking, the Kidneys. I remember the first time my sister's dad came to visit us after we'd moved to Oxford. He lives in India, and he laughed for a full minute when we told him that our local park was called the Kidneys. I mean, now I think about it, it is a ridiculous name, like calling a recreation ground the spleen. Which actually also makes me think of the time my friend had to have an ultrasound because she was having a bit of trouble with her pouch of Douglas. And if you don't know what a pouch of Douglas is, then boy, are you in for a treat. Give that little fella a Google and have yourself a lovely time. Now, my guest on The Panic Years this week is the comedian, actor, writer, and star of Ghosts and Stathlet's Flats, Katie Wicks. Katie's just published a phenomenal memoir called Delicacy, which, as she puts it, is all about cake and death. It's funny and wry and brutal and sad. In the book, Katie covers quite a bit of her panic years, from the crap jobs to the unhappy sex, moving to London, ambition and friendship. There's also quite a strong thread throughout the book about Katie's relationship to her body. So I want to warn you straight away that there is some discussion in this interview about disordered eating and body dysmorphia. We also have a guest interview with Tom Quinn from the eating disorder charity Beat, who explained a bit more about disordered eating and the type of help that's available. So, if you're not in a place where you're comfortable with that, then I completely understand. But I also hope that those of you who do listen find Katie as funny and kind and thoughtful as I did. Thank you for downloading, and I'll be back in a bit. How are you, and how is your body?
It's funny, isn't it? Because it is two separate answers, which is mad, because they are one and the same. I went for a little run, which is, no, I didn't think I'd ever say that, with my friend this morning. it's sort of like being 12. Like, for some reason now, every Saturday, it's like I do all these different activities, like guitar. Exercise. It's actually really lovely. But because I've exercised, it's so annoying, but my whole universe shifts depending on whether I've exercised or not. On the days I exercise, I'm the most relaxed, optimistic person you've probably ever met. But on the days I don't, I'm back to usual rolling around in my own shit kind of thing.
No, I know exactly what you mean. The days when I've done exercise, I just feel more comfortable in the world than on the days when I don't.
So I had like major surgery about a year ago where I had to have my gallbladder taken out. The gallbladder was in charge of digesting fat. So it meant that I couldn't digest fat. It was really strange.
Boy.
I was really sedentary after the operation because it's quite, you know, you're having an organ taken out. It was so full on and scary. So I was really, when I was healing, I just couldn't move at all, and I got so weak, and I didn't really have much muscle before, but I have even less now. So actually, like, really getting into exercise, but for the first time in my life, like the weights and all that stuff,
right,
it's been amazing because like my posture's better and I can stand for longer and I can like wash my hair in the shower without having tired arms, which is like a thing I...
You're making yourself sound like Kermit the Frog, that you were constantly sitting down with these little wiry arms that couldn't ever go above your head.
My arms were very pale and wiry. They were. Like, it is scary when you've been convalescing that you... It's like I kind of withered away.
Was that before or after you'd written the book, this period of stasis?
That's a really good question. During, in the middle.
When you said the gallbladder, which is in charge of, and I thought, I really hope she says writing.
Well, it's been removed now, so I guess that's no more books for me. Like it was my hair, like Samson's hair or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember really vividly the first chapter I wrote after the operation, and I think I was still weird from the anaesthetics. Mm-hmm. And I remember sort of saying to my friend, I'm really enjoying this chapter, but it's quite like, it's not like the others, it's kind of trippy. It's kind of being a bit mean about a personal trainer. I feel like the chapter was more about my attempts at engaging with that kind of thing at a young age and at a point in life where, you know, my relationship with my body was so bad that I couldn't really have very normal interaction with this woman. And she was just the wrong kind of, you know, personal trainer. It was this kind of weird, like, army results thing where, and I was really clear to her at the beginning, I didn't want, like, diet sheets and I didn't want to talk about weight or anything like that. I just sort of said to her really clearly, like, I am really weak and tired and I need you to put me in a better mood and to make me, to make my body stronger. In some ways, it's quite a celebration to be able to now engage with someone whose whole job is just, like, physicalness, but to be a bit more equal and be able to say, oh, I want this, I don't want that. Whereas I didn't know what I was trying to do when I went before. It was just all like really, you know, desperately weird and awkward.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about this actually, because the book obviously covers quite a lot of your life. I have this thing about The Panic Years, which is the book I've written, which I think for me kicked in at about 28. It's sort of a reckoning with your life and a reckoning with your body. And it causes all of these kind of knock-on effects to relationships and work and where you live and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of wanted to ask, what were you up to in your sort of late 20s, early 30s?
I had a really bad car accident that I write about in the book, and that was when I was 26. So there was about a year of recovering. It took about that long for the bones to knit together and just the whole, you know, the trauma of it. And it's funny, like, even now, like, I still get a bit nervous in cars. Like, if someone drives a bit too fast or I just, if we break suddenly, because the, it's probably too graphic to get into, but because the safety belt kind of broke all the bones in its path. Now, when I'm wearing a safety belt, if we break suddenly, it's like, it's not as bad, but it's like exactly the same injury, but just on a small scale. So I wear the safety belt like that. And then the Uber driver's like, can you not do that, please? And I have to like try and explain why I don't like to wear my safety. Anyway, so it's a whole thing.
So, wow. So no, even before you hit that kind of, I think, run up to turning 30 kind of reckoning with yourself, you'd had a genuine reckoning with mortality.
Yes, that definitely changed things. Because it was a near-death experience, absolutely. I was so lucky to survive it that I think I assumed it would be, you know, I'd be like born again. But this sort of opposite happened. I didn't feel lucky and amazing. I feel like I became a bit scared and I really catastrophized. I really waited for the next bad thing to happen because it was almost like, oh, bad things do happen, and they do just happen when you're least expecting it, and they happen all the time. And I got very morbid. Like, I remember I used to look around and I would think, oh, that person's, how have people managed to still be alive? Like, how's that person got to their 60s and they haven't died in some freakish way? Like, it seemed that I was so physically fragile, that my body was so fragile that...
Your birthday cards at this time must have been really lovely to friends and family. Happy, happy birthday. Well, how are you still here?
But that's the thing. Like, I am definitely... I read this article the other day called The Happy Depressive, and that's me. Like, no one ever knows. Right. Nobody ever knows. I'm a total functioning depressive, and I never show anybody because I don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. So it's kind of neither's good because you're not... I just assume it's alienating and too intense and people don't want to know, which is in a way why writing a book is like, well, people are just, I'm just forcing people to have to look at it now. They're just going to have to pay attention.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember 27 moving back to London, and 28 was when I started therapy for the first time ever. So I think you're right that it was exactly that point of sort of working out what I was good at, what I wasn't good at, why my friends could do some things that I found difficult, why I hadn't done these things with my life. It was like a sort of assessment of everything. And I didn't realise why I was unhappy. That's why I went to therapy. And it wasn't to do with the accident, because I think there was lots of things there before. And also my eating was crazy at this point and really disordered and bad. and really extreme, like, I mean, yeah, guide it without being triggering, like binging and purging, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think 28 was actually really sad time. And I think once I hit 30, it got better. But I remember my 30th, like that was also quite sad because I went to a restaurant with 10 friends, which should have been amazing, but I just remember how anxious I was and that I was never present for a second. I was just always, always so anxious. And I didn't even have pudding. You know, I just think I didn't sort of deserve one. So I think of my 30th as, and also I didn't really want to celebrate it because I didn't really want the attention. It felt too, so I'm sad about that. Because when other people describe their 30th as being full of joy, I just think, why was I being so masochistic?
Mine was wild. Mine was like a one-woman wedding, but I remember looking around because I remember really clearly at 30, my best friend from childhood had come to stay and we were sharing a bed and she was engaged and she owned a house and she was pregnant and I was single. I had just been made redundant. I was a complete mess in certain ways. And I remember having this huge party and like my dad's ex-wife was talking to a guy I'd slept with and someone from work was talking to like my cousin. I'm thinking this is all the worst bits of a wedding. And it's all
that's
on...
like a Miranda July short
and
story.
It's all on me. My ex-boyfriend was DJing. Loads of people I'd slept with all turned up. I think it is quite a febrile birthday, your 30th, unless you're someone who has trodden quite a conventional path and are quite grown up at 30. Do you think when you say you were very anxious, was that like a self-consciousness or did you feel out of sync with your peers?
When I think of my 30th, I can really see it now. It was a feeling of just being unable to relax and this little sense of doom and not knowing why. And this hyper self-consciousness and analysing everything that was happening. And then also because it's your birthday, feeling kind of on show and pressure to make sure everyone else is having a good time. Like a hyper-vigilance to every aspect of life.
Yes, it felt. And where was your career at this point?
Sometimes I have a tendency to only remember the bad of things and I don't know what that's about actually, because I think some people remember the good. So I think I was 31 when I made my sketch show with Anna Crilly, and that was like incredible. We'd done Edinburgh's and we'd been working towards trying to get our own stuff away for about 8 years, and I remember from those days at the Edinburgh Fringe, it felt so rare that someone would get picked up and like put on TV. It kind of felt like it just didn't happen that easily. And so I still kind of can't believe that we were actually given like a sketch show. And I mean, it was stressful because we really cared, but
yeah.
I've got such fond memories of how fun that was. But I also just remember how private it was, that it, you know, it was only like my therapist and two best friends that I think I would ever talk about this stuff with. So I guess which comes back to the thing I was saying about the mask of being okay, like was really firmly in place.
When you say you'd spent 8 years before your sketch show got commissioned, like did you have day jobs or were you making a living as an actor?
Yeah, it was a mix. Well, back in Cardiff, I had tons of shit, awful jobs.
I did wonder when you were working for the manufacture of bespoke ballet costumes.
Yeah. that's right. So that would have been round about 28, 29, 30. Yeah. Yeah, I was working in this ballet shop.
And did you have that thought of like, well, this is the career I've always dreamed of?
It was a question of this could be worse. I just kept thinking this could be so much worse. I was really left alone. No one gave a toss. And no one really ever came in. But yeah, like perfume counters I worked on in London. I was doing that during the day. Temping. There was a point where I had to sell a product called Nail Jazz. What's that big centre, like the home? It's like in the Excel Center. And
Oh, yeah.
So I was selling this thing called Nail Jazz.
Nail Jazz is a very brass-eye sort of name, isn't it?
Well, we called it Nail Jizz because we thought it was funny.
And, of course.
One of the things I had to do was kind of do a demonstration. So women would come over, or men, and I'd have to paint their nails to demonstrate this sort of horrible glitter. Just before gel, so it was like whatever it was. I think what happened is I got to about 4 o'clock and hated it so much that me and this girl just left, and she'd stolen some of the nail jizz, and we went to a pub and got really drunk, and then we got last minute tickets to Les Mis and cried all the way through Les Mis. I'd never met her before that day. And then I remember we got this really angry emails saying, "You've stolen the nail jazz and I know where you live. You've got to return the nail jazz." So I miss it. I miss all the adventures of my 20s and 30s, like deeply. Sometimes I just feel like life is so, it's not as predictable, but it's just, I just really miss leaving the house and not knowing where you're going to end up or who you're going to end up with at the end of the night.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, that I felt during that time that weirdly my work life was the area where I had almost the most control, because I could just sort of say yes and no to things. Actually, I said yes to everything. Whereas my relationship life, my private life, was just, I had no agency.
I'd relate to that. Yeah.
I felt like, you know, whether or not people loved me was entirely on them, and whether or not I was being fulfilled didn't come from myself. But was your career somewhere where you did have a sort of sense of autonomy and purpose? I mean, if you did 8 years of Edinburgh's, you must have had some sense that you were working towards something.
I'm really lucky, because from about the age of about maybe 27, I've just like worked pretty consistently. Like I just went from thing to thing. I agree, like work was where I got all my self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And how I looked was my whole self-esteem. Those were the two things.
Well, I've got a great quote from your book. You say to someone, I think it's when you're at university, you say to someone, it's more important to be thin than to be funny right now.
I knew you were going to say
sorry.
That. No, I could just sense it. No, it's good.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, one, it's incredibly familiar to me. And it's also, it's just such a powerful thing to hear another woman put it that boldly. There were points where, during my 20s particularly, and into my 30s, being thin or being attractive really did seem like the most important thing in the world, even though I can, you know, with my rational feminist brain, I can say, but what does it achieve? You know, what does it mean?
At university, like, I did this quite sort of pretentious, I mean, I loved it, like, performance arty degree. And it was, you know, we just thought we were really punk and avant-garde. And I feel like the aesthetic was just to be, like, thin and interesting. And I just didn't eat the whole 3 years. Like, it was such a priority. It makes me incredibly sad because, for so many reasons, it meant my brain didn't function, so I wasn't really learning anything. It meant that I wasn't really having a full experience of what should be an incredible time. And I was so tired all the time, and I was so cold all the time. And it just makes me really sad because I missed out on a lot because I sort of forgive myself for it because I think that's just the messages from my youth. It was just like, you can't begin to live unless you're thin. It's just not possible.
When you say your brain wasn't functioning, were you aware of it at the time? Like, did you know that was happening and doing it anyway, or did you not realise?
The sad thing is, at the time, I just was like, oh, you know, this is just really good calorie counting and I'm doing really well. And the hunger means it's working. And, you know, like I'm still functioning and I'm still, you know, I still got a 2-1. It's all fine. And it's not even nice to think about it, to be honest. It's just so. But it was tricky because when I was really ill before I had the gallbladder taken out, it was very difficult to digest. And for the first time really in about 10 years, I felt, you know, really starving, that level of starving. And I remember thinking, and I couldn't sleep, the pain in my stomach. And I just remember it was so kind of frightening to think that I ever did that voluntarily. It was really scary.
I'm so glad that you are not in that place now. I don't want to say that you're better, but I'm glad that that's not happening at the moment. There's this beautiful bit in the book, and I'm sort of interested what catalyzes or allows this to happen, where you talk about the most rebellious act imaginable, to eat what you want and to for your body to be the shape and size that it is. When was that in your life?
So, oh God, I mean, I talk about this honestly all night, because a few different things. So I think I was 30 when I read Fat is a Feminist Issue.
Seminal.
So that was a big deal. And then there were other books around that. There was one called When Women Stop Hating Their Bodies, which I love. Janine Roth's stuff I love. It's very sort of American and a bit hippie. And I put that on when I'm in a more gentle mood. So the idea of intuitive eating was, yeah, how I began to heal. And it was scary because I had to let go. And of course, my body just sort of did do what it wanted, you know, and it went up and down. And I'm trying not to make it, you know, about the size, because that's irrelevant. Mm. It's as my friend said the other day, it's the message, not the messenger. I thought, yeah, that's true. Like, it doesn't matter what size. But there was, you know, definitely that was part of it, the journey.
Hard though, right?
Yeah, it was scary and challenging and difficult. And I constantly got pulled back into the narrative of, you know, thin is good, fat is bad. There were also times where I was tiny, and then I would still get sent through a part for like a fat person, inverted commas. So that was also really just completely distorted and disordered, because I was sort of a size 12, and I was still I remember going to an audition. It was for a sort of show set in a fashion office or something. There was a sort of scene where someone was calling the character I was auditioning for fat, and they sort of said to me, well, you know, it's obviously because in the world of fashion, size 12 is fat, so, you know, so don't be offended, because we're seeing girls like size 14. And I just left. Like, I couldn't handle it. It was poisonous. So even when I was tiny, I was never small enough. And when I was, you know, it was just all so mad, trying to fit into this very narrow aesthetic.
And that incredible thing that someone says to you, where they say you'll either have to lose a lot of weight or put on a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And I do think that's one thing that I sort of learned. The honest life is one caught in between all sorts of different states, whether that's size or your emotional state, or you're in a constant state of transition, and that's the only honest state that there is. And so
completely.
Know, the idea that
being like in a living body,
yeah,
that's an up and down process. And I sometimes like to dip in and remind myself of the principles. There's this amazing book by Aubrey Gordon, What We Don't Talk About, We Talk About Fat.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all about fat bias and thin privilege. And then I sort of started to learn about, you know, the idea that actually it could be a political statement to defy that you should look a certain way. That it was a way of sort of saying no, which I thought was incredible, amazingly powerful. I'm not always, if I'm honest, like, it's hard to fight every day. I have days where I'm tired and I just think, oh, it would just be easier. It would be easier to look, like, correct.
Also, I just couldn't hear that. I could, like, you could have said all of these things to me in my 20s and I probably would have nodded along, and it wouldn't have landed.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have meant the same thing to me as it does now. I wouldn't have understood it. You know, I think you have to live it, live in your body and live your life and go through. I mean, you've gone through much, much more trauma than I have. But I think it's only after that you're maybe susceptible to the truth of that message, I think.
Yeah, I think that I didn't trust that I was enough without my body. And I think now that I feel like I finally have more substance. But then even that's kind of dangerous, because I would think things like, oh, well, you know, I'll have to be really funny, or this person won't, you know, they won't fancy me just on like looks alone. I'll have to sort of do something else. Yeah. I mean, it's all so tragic. Or I'd think, No, I'm just going to concentrate on looks alone this week. And then I don't need to say, you know, it's real sort of binaries. And
I remember saying to a therapist, genuinely, all I want is for someone to just give me an objective view on how attractive or not attractive I am. I just want to stand in a room completely naked and have a heterosexual man just look me over and tell me genuinely how attractive I am, objectively. And like, this was 8 years ago, yeah, when I was 28. And he brought it up the other day, my therapist. And I was like, that's a very ill thing to say.
Wow.
Also, a very weird.
Why did you choose a male therapist?
Oh, like a lifetime of issues with men.
That's so interesting, because that made me go towards a woman therapist.
See, I felt like I had so many women in my life that talked to about my feelings, like, and who I had that kind of close, open, vulnerable relationship with. What I didn't have was an older man with whom I could be emotionally vulnerable, or any man with whom I could be emotionally vulnerable.
I worry I'd fall in love with my male therapist.
You can fall in love with mine.
But I wouldn't.
You
know.
Can't fall in love with your own. Reading your book, I think one of the scenes that struck me most, and that I then wanted to go on and talk to people about, is when you are driven to set by the husband of someone who bullied you when you were at school. And I remember thinking that, like, when I talk about wanting the validation of people, like, I remember thinking that must have felt so validating. Your revenge is your own success. But when you are, let's say, on TV, or you're being driven to set, or you're at an awards do, or whatever, is there a part of you that thinks, yes, through this, I have the validation over all the people who personally rejected, underestimated, hurt me?
Yes and no. I was really quiet in school, and I sort of kept thinking, I'm just going to bide my time, and then sort of, and then when I speak, it will be like really big.
All right, Oscar Wilde.
And it will be like on a stage, or it will be, yeah, it was like my way of coping, I think, of like just being like so introverted and shy. I thought it's okay. I'll just become a writer or something. It's fine. There'll be a time where I speak. It will be fine. So yeah, in terms of being underestimated, it's really helped me to get to the point where I could write a book. Definitely. Definitely. And I'm so bad at, like, even when I've been doing bits of press for it, I find it so hard to do a convincing job of saying, this is really good, everyone. Like, I really undersell it. So I'm still pretty crap at it. But what's interesting with that girl, with what happened, I think the thing is, well, first of all, I think that the reason it doesn't feel validating is because I'd have to buy into that sort of system that status is based on, like being on TV. And I think that I know that so many people in TV are really unhappy. So I just don't, I can't buy into it. And also I know that if I'm looking for revenge, it's probably that I'm going to have resentment. They go hand in hand. And because I'm in recovery and I go to 12-step meetings, I know that I can't have resentment. Otherwise, I just fall back into like destructive patterns. Like, I think revenge is bad for me. And also, I think it doesn't work long term. I think it only works in the short term. The thing that really worried me about seeing that girl that did bully me in school is the idea that there'd be a moment where I went back to being 12 and I didn't stand up for myself, and that would be really devastating to get to this age and not really be able to trust myself to not be bullied. Like, that would be so upsetting to me.
This doesn't paint me in a particularly good light to a lot of people, but I remember thinking, all I want is to write a column for The Guardian. That's all I want. And then at, let's say, 28, I did. And then there was this huge recalibration of like, oh, so if I've achieved professional success now,
Yeah.
What happens next? Like, what do I, where is my, not even my drive, because I was still very ambitious, but it was like, if I didn't have a signifier of success anymore because I'd achieved it and I yeah. didn't feel successful. And I think that's the weird, that's quite a weird
yeah,
experience.
And also the feeling of, I'm going to use the phrase hedonic adaptation, which I find so interesting.
At last.
Finally.
wondering when you're going to bring it up.
Because I really, yeah, experienced that the goalposts keep moving. It's like with my Nintendo Switch that I got for Christmas. I waited ages for this one game and I played it 10 times and was like, what's a better game than this? I'm sure there must be a better game. My friend said it's like looking for the right porn film to get the best orgasm possible. I was like, that's really funny. No, not that. There's something that's going to get me like more turned on than that. Not that. Keep going.
That's lovely. Your career is like the sort of pornographic quest for a high.
Yep. I give a lot of pleasure to a lot of people.
At last, one of my guests finally read my memo about hedonic adaptation. I've been dropping hints for months. Thank you so much to Katie for talking to me. If you haven't already, do go out and buy Delicacy. It's out now in hardback and, hooray, bookshops are open again. In fact, if you're going to the bookshop, why not pick up a copy of The Panic Cures for your Auntie Reenie while you're there? As I mentioned in my conversation with Katie, sometimes it's hard to discuss disordered eating and the ways we treat our bodies without accidentally falling into some harmful, even dangerous habits or stereotypes. I've had a lifelong messy, sometimes damaging relationship with food, exercise and my body. So I wanted to speak to BEAT, the UK eating disorder charity, to find out more about this form of illness and what help is available. I spoke to Tom Quinn, their Director of External Affairs. What I wanted to ask is, how common are eating disorders? But I actually think maybe the more pertinent question is, how many people in the UK at the moment are likely to be suffering from an eating disorder?
That's a really excellent question. The short answer is we don't know. In general, there isn't enough research into eating disorders, and there isn't enough research into the prevalence, into the number of people that actually have eating disorders. The estimate that we use is based on a bit of work we did a few years ago where we looked at some studies, all of them international, and then tried to extrapolate that to the UK. And the figure we came up with was 1.25 million. We actually think it may be higher. There was a survey that the NHS did in 2019. They asked some questions that are usually used as a sort of screening tool. What it means is that if you answer yes to them, it suggests that you might have an eating disorder and therefore you should, you know, be asked further questions and follow up and that it's worthy of investigation. So that survey found that, and this was a survey of the general public, 16% of people on that measure screened positive for a possible eating disorder. Now, I don't think all of those people will have had an eating disorder, but you know, if you think, what, 16% of, I don't know, 65, 70 million people, you know, you're talking about, you know, 10 plus million people. Now, as I said, to be clear, I don't think that many people actually have an eating disorder. But what's also interesting is that that survey was conducted 12 years ago. And at that point, only 6% screened positive for a possible eating disorder. So,
oh my goodness, that's quite an increase.
We know that every year more and more people are seeking help, but it's always been difficult to determine, is that because more people are just aware that they might have a problem, which of course is a really good thing, or is it because the problem's getting bigger? But I think, you know, this survey definitely suggests that whatever's happening is getting worse, I think.
Can anyone get an eating disorder?
What we know is that about 90% of the people that receive help are female, and it's fantastic they're getting help. We believe that the actual proportion of people who are affected by eating disorders is more like a 75-25% split. So that does suggest, unfortunately, that there are a lot of men, a lot of boys out there that are not getting the help they need. There's also, I think, a perception that it's an illness that predominantly affects young people. Actually, there are more adults with an eating disorder than there are children and young people. And it really can affect anyone of any ethnicity, any background. There's no indication that it, you know, affects anyone differently, irrespective of their background.
You've touched on something that I also wanted to ask about, which is, I think there's an idea that you sort of have an eating disorder or you don't. And actually, it's far more likely that you will have disordered eating that maybe creeps up on you, and you might not even necessarily identify that as something until it's pointed out to you either by an external event or some kind of internal change. And I wondered, are there sort of behaviours or signs that you would point people towards to say, this is something that you need to be aware of or maybe be concerned by in yourself?
How people who have an eating disorder often describe their eating disorder is as a coping mechanism. It's actually, for most people, really not actually about the food itself. It's about, for some, it can be about what it does to their bodies. So for many people, they do have perhaps concerns about their body image or about their weight and shape. And that is common, but not the case for everyone. But also often it's almost a sort of proxy for other negative thoughts, emotions, feelings. So that people who are likely to restrict their eating often describe doing so almost as a way of seeking to gain control. Mm-hmm. So that if they feel like sort of other parts of their life are out of control, that this is at least something that they can grasp hold of. People who are more likely to binge more likely describe that binging as almost a sort of loss of control because of low self-esteem. People will overeat, and we're talking, I won't go into details, but sort of huge amounts of food in one sitting, and then feel even guiltier afterwards. And unfortunately, the sort of cycle continues. So I think a useful way to think about it is if food is taking on an emotional role in your life, that you look to food essentially to sort of fill needs or to satisfy negative feelings that you can't satisfy elsewhere. I think, yes, people will often then turn to it as that coping mechanism in lieu of other much healthier coping mechanisms, whether that be, you know, speaking to friends and family about what's going on or different sort of social activities or whatever it be. And so I would say that if people are listening and sort of thinking about their loved ones, sometimes it's obviously harder to tell quite what's going on in people's heads. But I think if you are noticing that people are skipping meals, or they say, oh, I've already eaten, or I'm eating later, if people seem to be becoming more isolated, that's often associated with people with eating disorders of any type. They seem to be sort of shutting themselves off from social circles or activities they used to enjoy before. If people are more likely to purge, then there are signs that you can sometimes tell. You know, if people are frequently going to the loo, you know, straight after meals, you know, unfortunately, that can be a sign that they're purging. If people are binging, then sometimes you may notice, because suddenly overnight, and it's often overnight, a lot of food will essentially disappear from the house. People of all eating disorders actually often will be much more tired, either because they're not getting the energy they need from their food, or, you know, if they're binging, they'll often be up kind of at night doing that, because essentially they're ashamed of that behavior, and therefore they're doing it when no one else is around to see them.
If you suspect that in yourself your eating is getting more disordered, or that you are starting to use food in an unhealthy way, or exercise or whatever, where can you go for help at the moment? What can you do?
So the first thing I want to say, even before I answer that question, is really emphasize the importance of getting help and help quickly. Saying that, I don't want anyone listening who feels like they've been struggling for years to think that they're beyond help. That's not what I'm saying. But the research is clear that the sooner you get help, the easier it is to recover. Because it's, you know, it's a mental illness, it's an illness that's affecting the brain. There's research that shows that you can actually physically see it in the brain in terms of changes that happen in terms of people's thought processes and how they sort of process information, process thoughts and feelings. And over time, those behaviors, that way of thinking, can become harder to challenge. We firmly believe that you can recover from an eating disorder. You know, if you're worried about yourself or someone else, get help quickly. Now, so we have a helpline that's open every day of the year. You can email us. We have online support groups. We have online message boards and sort of online one-to-one chat. Loads of different ways that people can contact us. And we also put a lot of information on our website.
Hello, welcome back, and thank you for listening right to the end. I'm still here, in the kidneys, with my kidneys, getting a tiny bit stung by nettles and listening to the birds fighting for their territory above my head. Thank you so much to Katie Wicks and Tom Quinn for talking to me for this episode. Thank you to my partner in podcasting, Rich Jarman, for producing it. And thank you to everyone who's listened, subscribed, and already given us a nice review. Next week's guest is the journalist, author, and queer father, Casper Salmon. Casper and I had a brilliant chat about his panic years, leaving his secure, boring job, and the representations of queer identity in the media. So come back next week to hear that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually, even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts so more people can find it. Like smelling blossom on a warm day, it's completely free and will make you feel lovely.
This is a brand new audio production.